It's February 19th, and we're with Jerry Faust for the Pew Scholars interview. And I wanted to start off today with asking a question that in one area that we didn't bring up, but is pretty important in the development of a person, and that is, did you have any religious training or did you, kind of traditional religious values in your home? Growing up?
Mm-hmm. Not a whole lot. But I think the values were there, but
right.
There wasn't any formal training.
Yeah.
I don't really recall my mother and father going to church themselves. So we're Christians. And my brother and I think more prompted more by my grandmother, my paternal grandmother. Saw to it that we started the church when we were very young and went until we were in our mid-teens and then kind of got out of habit, you know,
right.
And haven't been back since. So I don't think that had a real impact on my, certainly my professional career. I hope that the values that I learned there had an impact on my personality and any good features that I have. But nevertheless, there were good moral lessons that we learned at home from my parents and not just necessarily in a religious context.
Mm-hmm. And has any of these kind of these more what we consider religious values carried on today in your life?
Well, there were good moral values that I think that have carried on, but and I'm sure they're probably related to important lessons or training in the scriptures, but I couldn't quote you.
Right. Yeah, so nothing formal,
right.
Organized.
Mm-hmm. And I don't attend a church regularly now. Regularly would be an exaggeration. Too. I haven't been. The only time I go to church is weddings and funerals. Yes. Are becoming a little frequent.
Okay. Well, also I wanted to follow up on, we didn't discuss too much, but you kind of just mentioned that you were in the honors program in science and math in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how would you describe the preparation you had in high school, particularly, you're obviously in the top groups of your classes if you were in the honors program, and you're learning about your instructors are trying to teach you about things that are happening with the ATP articles, taking articles out of journals and reading them. Well,
mm-hmm.
Look or Life, whatever it was.
No, that's a good point.
And then how did this compare to the kinds of work, kind of the ways of instruction that you had in college?
Well, I think it was a real good program for me because it did give me an opportunity to have a more meaningful experience with early science education and kind of a leg up on students that weren't in the honors science program or math. And I'm sure that kind of helped me in college, although remember I wasn't all that great of a student, so maybe if I hadn't been in the honors program I would have been an even worse student. But when I think about the early experiences that kind of began, that prodded me to go into science, it was clear that that eighth grade biology class and then my chemistry teacher were right up there at the top of the list. And those were all due to the fact that I was in an honors program and was in that class. So if nothing else, it just kind of continued the smoldering interest that I had in science, so that by the time I was midway through my college days, that it seemed appropriate to make the decision to go in that direction, as opposed to business or athletics or whatever. I don't know that it helped me to better prepare me for science at the college level, because that just seemed like a different coursework altogether. This different material that was covered. You know, for instance, in The first biology course I took was a botany course in college. And, you know, we never had anything to do with botany in high school. It was all more animal type biology. So that was kind of unusual, I thought. But that was a school that was down there, had a strong agricultural program and forestry program, so botany was a big thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, in terms of levels of effort in high school, how did you come to be in these honors programs? Was it?
Well, evidently some information came to the Dallas Independent School District on me from Sterrett. Now, I don't. The answer is I don't know. I've thought about it. How it was that I got placed in that program?
Yeah.
It may have been a mistake. Maybe they got me mixed up with somebody else. But because when I went into Oliver Wendell Holmes Junior High School, I remember that I was placed into one class, and only stayed there about 3 days, and then got moved into this other class that was centered around honors, and. I just came home one day and told Mother that, you know, I was no longer in Mrs. So-and-so's, who was kind of the homeroom. That's where you started the day, I guess. I was in Mrs. So-and-so's, you know. And she says, well, what's the difference? And I said, well, that now I'll be, so this was in the seventh grade. I said, well, I'm in the eighth grade. I'll take biology instead of waiting till the ninth grade. And then I was taking, it was just, you stepped up the math, too, so I guess I took algebra and maybe the eighth grade, and then geometry in the ninth grade, which was a step ahead. So I don't know how it happened. I just assumed that there was some kind of communication there, and then maybe as a result of a test that I took in elementary school or what have you, that standard score.
Yeah. So are you a natural then, or were you a natural for the sciences?
Probably. Although when I was in high school, I used to like to write, and I thought I was pretty good at it, but I really wasn't. But I think that was just more or less expression, you know, just wanting to express myself about different things. So I thought if anything, I'd be a natural at that. But you know, by the time I got to college and really started becoming burdened with composition, I could see that I wasn't very good at it. And still, I suffer in that category.
Mm-hmm. Had you considered perhaps doing something more in the lines of the humanities or the social sciences rather than the physical and biological sciences?
Not really. You know, I was always kind of just right there in the science and math departments, and,
yeah.
And the only time I went over liberal arts was to take the courses that were required.
Okay, and you had also mentioned, you know, that on this field trip, you saw this huge campus and were, you know, introduced to topics, physics topics like fusion and fission. And you also said you were good in math. And had you thought at any time that perhaps you'd go into physics or more mathematical, analytical?
Not so much physics, but I really enjoyed the mathematics at the level through calculus, because that was gratifying, you know, to solve an algebraic equation at, you know, in the eighth grade or to solve problems and get it right. You know, there's some feedback there,
right.
And calculus was sort of that way, you know. So, but I think I only took one course beyond differential equations was a good example of that, but. Beyond that, then, I guess it became more theoretical and less yes and no, right or wrong type of feedback. And that kind of turned me off a little bit to it, I think.
Yeah.
You know, I guess the same sort of thing applies in science, but if there's no really yes and no answers, it's just gray lots of times. But for lack of a better answer, I think that's. I did consider math and liked it and studied well in math, but I really never considered physics. You know, I just viewed it as visiting the University of Texas was an opportunity just to see science in action,
yeah,
and to experience or to listen to some of the people who were doing it. And it didn't make a difference whether it was, you know, I could see it was broad enough that physics probably wasn't that much different in the day-to-day lives of biologists than a biologist,
yeah,
or a chemist.
Well, a lot of Pew scholars who were going to high school in the 60s talk about how many programs or opportunities for summer-type programs because of the space program and just the amount of level of funding towards scientific education in the 60s and the early 70s. And being in Texas, was there a big kind of push on students to perhaps, you know, develop interests in kind of aerospace engineering or become an astronaut? Did you eat your Twisps or whatever, you know, Tang, I guess it was, mm-hmm, and have these opportunities, or were you aware of these opportunities to do summer type research or kind of extra programs in the sciences?
Yes, I was aware of them. There was quite a bit of publicity. So every high school bulletin board had applications or information about applying for summer internships at NASA and associated universities. So, you know, University of Houston had labs that were collaborating with NASA, as Rice and Texas A&M. And I think some of the students in my high school did go down there. I never applied and never really thought about it. I guess mainly because it was more physical.
Yeah. Okay.
And I guess I never got turned on to engineering either, yeah, the practical side of it. So I did not have any summer positions that allowed me to develop an interest in science one way or another. I worked every summer, but it was at, you know, other types of jobs.
Of course, NASA was in Houston, too, and there was
That's correct. That's correct. That's correct.
Okay. Well, I think where we left off yesterday was with you're finishing up your master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
And moving on to the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center and as a research assistant associate. And how did you find out about the job? You had mentioned that you wanted to go back. I just find a job after the master's was a terminal kind of thing for you, and you wanted to return to industry or get a job. And how did you go about getting the job at the University of Texas?
Well, I probably went there and applied in the employment office,
okay,
as I did in several other of the hospitals around there, Baylor, Wadley Blood Bank, the Miller Brewery in Fort Worth. I mentioned yes, and I did. So I just applied, and I can remember two interviews that I had at the medical center. One with the only person I talked to when I first interviewed with Brown and Goldstein was Mike, and another one in the anesthesiology department, which was around the corner and from their offices, and it was more animal type physiology. So anesthesiologists to me have always kind of looked at animals in terms of model systems to study their drugs. So this was one of those laboratories, and, you know, I wasn't keen into, not that I would be squeamish about working with animals. I just didn't think that would hold my interest as well as something. I was beginning to come up with ideas about molecular biology and cell biology, and so that's, I think, what I wanted to do. And so I think I had another interview. I had an interview that, actually, this is an interesting story. So I had an interview at Wadley Blood Bank too, which is a research institution. I mean, their principal responsibility is just processing blood for all the Dallas hospitals. But then I think their investigators could do some, get extramural funding and do research. And so there was a position open there that I applied for and had an interview. And it was, I think, a project that was more immunology based. At that time, I guess probably studying, I don't remember all the details, but just expression of cell surface markers on different populations of lymphocytes to characterize lymphocyte differentiation. So that was, you know, pretty cellular, molecular. I thought that was, that certainly would satisfy my interest. And but I mean, Mike Brown was an impressive, is an impressive individual from the get-go, from day one. He really, I met in his office, and he asked me to describe my master's thesis, and I did. And it's purely a metabolic problem dealing in bacteria. And I could tell that he didn't have, although he was keen on metabolic pathways, that it wasn't his forte. You know, he was more of he was an MD, and he knew it. But he had sufficient interest and common knowledge that he was really motivated to hear what I had to say and to make suggestions, as if it was an ongoing project, and it wasn't. And I don't remember a whole lot about what he described, but I was certainly pleasantly impressed with the interview that I had with him. Unfortunately, the job salary was much lower at Southwestern than it was at Wadley, coupled with the fact that at that time, Wadley wasn't deducting Social Security because it was a private organization. And then the medical school was deducting Social Security as well as Texas State Teachers Retirement. So the take-home difference was really enormous. So initially I took the job at Wadley. In my mind I took it. I never told them, yeah. And so in my mind I took it, but I was going to go back and tell them when Mike called and said they wanted to have another interview. So I went back, and this time I did talk to Joe, along with Mike. And they offered me a job, and I explained, well, you know, there's a difference in salary, and I'm motivated enough by the dollar that I'd probably take this other. And they said, well, if we match this salary, will you come work for us? And I said, yeah, because I thought it would be more interesting at that time. So Joe was head of medical genetics in the Department of Medicine, and part of that task, his responsibility was to oversee a cytogenetics or a genetic counseling clinic that was fed into by information from a cytogenetics lab at Children's, which was right next door to Parkland and part of the medical center complex. So the woman I was involved with was a technician who worked in the cytogenetics labs and then went to conference once a week that was supervised by Joe. So I got information about Joe from Kathy. And she was right that Joe is a unique person also, a really intensely driven, motivated individual, and but obviously was going to be successful, and one could have an enormous opportunity to learn and grow in his environment. And then I could see, I thought that would be also the case with Mike. So, you know, it didn't take a lot of brain power to say, okay, there's some real opportunity here. And I don't know what they're doing. You know, I don't know the stuff about the LDL receptor or whatever, but, you know, they're in the Department of Medicine at a major medical center. They're both well-funded, and they come from excellent programs. This is as good an opportunity as you're going to get to grow. So when they offered me the same money, I said, sure, I'll take it, you know. And so I went home and called Wadley and said I wouldn't take their job. And I was supposed to start to work, I don't know, in like 3 or 4 days. And I remember it was a Saturday afternoon, about hot Saturday afternoon, about 3 o'clock. And I was way out on the back part of this property that we had that were mending some fences for these horses when Mike called. And I had to come in and I was kind of amazed that they were working on Saturday afternoon, but he unfortunately told me that he had checked with human resources or personnel at that time and that due to limitations in the structure of where people can be, what people can be paid based on their experience and educational history, that they couldn't offer me, they couldn't pay me that money, and I'd have to start at considerably less. Now I was really disappointed, you know. Here I was gonna have my cake and eat it too. I was gonna learn a lot and then get paid for it. But it was hot that day and I was tired and I'd already told Wadley I didn't want to go there. I didn't want to start looking again. And I says I'll just show up anyway. So that's how I started. So I think I was originally hired as a replacement for a really remarkable technician that had worked with them for 2 or 3 years up until that time, Susanna Dana, and had done a lot to get that program underway, and she was going to go off to medical school. So, but she didn't go off right away. She stayed there. We overlapped for about a year and a half, and then finally went off to medical school. So I think that was and coupled with the fact that Mike told me later on that they were beginning to start a project that required some skills in synthetic organic chemistry, very, very crude, minor, basic skills, and then also in chromatography, separation of light compounds by gas liquid chromatography as well as thin layer chromatography, and neither one of them had any experience in that, but I did. More of the latter, more of a lie than anything, you know, because I knew what a gas chromatograph was and I'd done some simple TLC, but I knew it was pretty easy. But he said that they were wanting to do some experiments that required this technology and that I could do it. So he said that was a motivation for offering me the position also. And I was successful at doing all those things that they wanted done initially too, which helped me along.
How long had they been at Southwestern by that time, and had they already combined their labs when you had gotten there?
So I think Joe came, I think they'd only been there about 2 or 3 years. Joe came first. Joe was a graduate of Southwestern. And and they met. Mike was a graduate of UPenn. And they met when they were interns and residents here at MGH and became friends. Then they went off and did fellowships at the NIH. Mike with Earl Stotman and Joe with Nuremberg. And stayed together there, I think, and solidified their friendship. And people speculated, so maybe they were formulating future plans at that time. I don't know. But then Joe went and took a position in Seattle to really begin to set the framework for studying LDL metabolism and defining the genetic inheritance of familial hypercholesterolemia type 2. And that enabled him to come to Southwestern as at a little bit higher level than Mike. I think Joe came as an associate professor and head of the Division of Medical Genetics. Whereas Mike actually came as a postdoc with John Deechee. No, with Marvin Sipperstein. I'm sorry, with Marvin Sipperstein. So, but I guess I always felt like there was an underlying understanding that Mike would become a faculty member right away, and indeed he did. But about the time I came, although they had separate labs, and Mike still, I think Sipperstein had just left, and Mike was setting up his own lab, and they were still separate, it was clear that they were going to be fusing together on their experiments and projects. Mike's was on the floor above Joe's, and so there was constantly communications back and forth. So altogether, I guess Joe had probably been there about 4 years and Mike maybe two.
And had they already started work identifying and characterizing the LDL receptor?
Mm-hmm. There were, at that time, about the time I came, they just began to formulate the idea that this receptor exists. The preliminary data before that just pointed to the fact that patients who turned out to have a mutation in the receptors, just were not responding to lipoprotein-containing serum. But, you know, they didn't know what components were missing when you remove the lipoproteins, obviously all the lipoproteins. And the response was just to measure a known regulatory, what we know now to be a regulatory response that cells evoke when cultured in the presence of lipoproteins, measuring cholesterol synthesis, HMG-CoA reductase, which was Mike's forte. Mike knew how to measure HMG-CoA reductase activity. So that helped, I think, once again solidify that collaboration. And it was from that simple assay that they realized that the component in serum that the cells were not responding to was indeed LDL. And later, and that's about the time I came, and they later went on to develop a binding assay to show that the reason they don't respond is that they don't take it up, and started this whole business, which is an amazing continual story. I mean, I just reviewed, and I just gave a lecture at 11 o'clock about what I call the latest onion skin in this story about cholesterol-mediated regulations in cell, and it's work from their lab.
And what did you start working on when you entered the lab? What did you start working on, and you know, mm-hmm. how far had they? It's during this first 74 that they kind of do the work that the kind of the fundamental work that gets them the Nobel Prize. Is that correct? And mm-hmm. where were you in this kind of
well,
scheme?
So they had an intuition that removing and adding lipoproteins to the media had something to do with cholesterol metabolism, because lipoproteins contain primarily cholesterol. And in patients who don't have this receptor, there's this enormous accumulation of a cholesterol in their serum because the cells can't take it up and get rid of it. The liver can't take it up and get rid of it. So they wanted to have ways to quantitate cholesterol content in cells. Presumably, if a cell has a receptor and it's taking up lipoproteins, then it's taking up cholesterol. But if cells don't have this receptor, don't take up the lipoproteins, then their cholesterol level in those cells might be lower. So it comes down to a basic procedure to just measure the cholesterol content in cells. And that's where the gas chromatograph comes in, because you can use that to separate cholesterol away from all other interfering substances that are present in cells, and then the gas chromatograph can actually quantitate that. So they wanted to be able to see if the non-responding cells were somehow or another taking up the lipoprotein and becoming and taking up cholesterol. So I set up they purchased the gas chromatograph, and I got a book and read the book and learned how to use the gas chromatograph and learned how to measure cholesterol in cells, and indeed showed that whereas normal cells that could respond to this lipoprotein when cultured in the presence of lipoprotein had a higher cholesterol content versus the mutant cells that couldn't respond to the lipoprotein, cholesterol content did not change. So they weren't taking up the lipoprotein. And then to further that indication or to substantiate that observation, a more direct way to show that they're not taking up the lipoprotein-derived cholesterol is to label the cholesterol part of the lipoprotein with, say, tritiated cholesterol, and then to show that radioactivity from tritiated cholesterol-labeled lipoproteins was transferred to normal cells, and that you saw the appearance of tritiated cholesterol. Whereas that transfer, that uptake of the tritiated radioactivity didn't occur in the mutant cells. So the predominant form of cholesterol in lipoproteins is as cholesterol esters, which is it's an ester of cholesterol and fatty acids as opposed to just free cholesterol. And at that time, there wasn't any, you couldn't buy radio-labeled tritiated cholesterol esters. So they had to be made. so a simple organic reaction was to just take fatty acids that are in the form of fatty acyl chlorides and react them with tritiated cholesterol that you could buy and form labeled cholesterol esters and purify them, work it up, and then incorporate it into the lipoprotein and show indeed that by just monitoring radioactivity, the mutant cells didn't take up the cholesterol, so that explains why they don't accumulate cholesterol, or they don't, their cholesterol content does not increase. So, like, as I pointed out before, I guess just being able to, and then separating, the TLC comes in to separate cholesterol from, say, cholesterol esters. The cells also take up this cholesterol and turn right around and hydrolyze it to free cholesterol, then also re-esterify it. So there's this cycle of cholesterol esters comes in, gets hydrolyzed to free cholesterol, then the cell moves it to another part of the position in the cell and re-esterifies it. So you have to be able to separate free and esterified cholesterol. And you wouldn't want to do that in a gas chromatograph and put all this radioactivity out in the air. So the best way to do it was by thin layer chromatography. So I think, and I was fortunately was successful at meeting those goals early on, which I gave me a lot of confidence because it required that I go to the library, get a book on gas chromatography, figure out a synthesis for cholesterol and oleate purification, work on some TLC systems, and do this on my own. So that gave me confidence that, you know, that I could do some part of a small research project, which I really didn't have from my master's work, remember, because Ed kind of led me around, told me what to do. And then also, I guess, the small measure of success gave them confidence that I could function at this master's level, which was supposedly a step above a technician. Mm-hmm. Or no, I was still a technician, but step above just a baccalaureate technician. Yes.
How did you see how many people were in their
labs
at this time?
All right, so there was Gloria Brumschetti. She was Joe's technician. And then there was a tissue culture technician, Helen Bumfock. And then Susie Dana was Mike's technician. And then Mike had a postdoc, Patty. Something or another, I can't remember her last name. So between the two labs, I guess there were five of us, not counting Joe and Mike. And then now Joe had an office. He had his own secretary who was part of this being head of medical genetics. And then there was another woman that helped out with genetic counseling, Mary Jane, last name I can't remember. But those were kind of, they weren't part of the research lab. They were administrative. So I hope I haven't left anybody out. Somebody will be able to read these, you know. But people began to start coming. Things began to grow from that point.
And you had mentioned coming into the lab that you didn't know what they were working on. But as you started working in the lab, when were you aware of kind of the significance and the significance of the work that you were doing?
I don't think I became aware of the significance early on. I think it probably was, you can measure it in years. I mean, I knew that this disease existed, that there was this genetic trait that led to early onset atherosclerosis. I guess I didn't know its frequency, so I didn't know it was as frequent in the population as it is. So that was hidden from me in terms of adding significance. I guess when I first became aware that they were doing significant work in that they began to win some prizes and got national recognition. So this probably was, you know, late 70s. I mean, really, the only thing I cared about was that I was having a good time. It was fun. It was hard work. And I could, and I knew that from reading other scientific, from reading the literature, that the things that were going on in that lab was at the cutting edge of science. Whether it's, by that time, the idea of receptor-mediated or ligand-mediated receptor interactions was coming about. And here, you know, we were studying one. And the cell biology associated with it. So I guess that was significant to me, that, that I was in a position to continue to grow if I wanted to. And then they had a lot of, they were getting recognition within the medical center community also. In terms of more space and more resources, you know, that I know doesn't just come to everybody. And they had a lot of support from the chairman of the medicine at that time, Don Selden, who was a real supporter of their efforts. And so other people that I also began to respect and admire and mimic there at the medical center, like Gene Wilson and Dan McGarry, John Beachy, also respected them, and you could see it, that they saw something that special going on there. So when you began to realize that people at that level had a certain feeling, then even though I couldn't feel it, it's worth staying around.
Well, you had experience working in like material sciences, where you used your chemistry and biochemistry skills somewhat, and then you go into a job that's very, that you're using a lot of your biochemistry. And how did moving away from kind of this industrial applied orientation influence how you saw your own knowledge and skills and abilities now that you're in a very clinically driven biological environment, academic environment?
Well, it really showed a weakness in my training, because I struggled quite a bit with some of the concepts and that I was learning and manipulating on a day-to-day basis. But fortunately, Mike Brown's a great teacher, and both of them are real hands-on investigators. So they would try to set up a protocol and experiments as much as possible with technicians and with postdocs even. I mean, you can talk to their postdocs even to this day, that usually within the first year, it's a one-on-one situation between them, that they instruct these postdocs what to do and how to do it. And when and I interacted a lot with him in some of the basic biochemical studies that I was doing, and he was really very very good at explaining the workings of the cell. Not, I mean, I could understand the assay and what we're doing; that wasn't any problem. But why we were doing it and what the impact of a result was, and which really helped me to, I think, understand the big picture. And then later began to, and that filtered down into the to the finer points of the observations that we were making. So the answer is that I was really, I struggled quite a bit because I didn't have the basic background information that fit into this job. But fortunately, I think primarily through the efforts of Mike, that he brought me up to speed as quickly as, perhaps it could have been quicker for other people, but brought me up to speed to where, you know, I could not work on my own, but at least understand where we were going, and why we were doing, and what's the implications of results and the like.
Well, how much of a background in biochemistry had either one of them had? What were their biochemical skills?
Well, I think pretty strong. I mean, they went. I assume both of them have baccalaureate degrees, and I suspect they're in sciences of some sort,
right,
as most pre-meds. And they did postdocs at the NIH in biochemical laboratories, Earl Stottman and Nuremberg's. So I think they have had a strong biochemical background. But then, you know, Joe believed in the universality of genetics, that genetic experiments, although sometimes may give us confusing interpretations, or the results may be confusing, that they are universal. You've got, if you compare one sibling that's a twin, a pair of twins, and one that's carrying a mutation, then all other things are just about equal except for that single gene. Or let's make it simplified even better, on a cell line that you've made a mutant cell line. So if you've got two cells that are identical with respect to all genes except one, then any differences that you observe, say biochemically or molecularly or physiologically, between those two cells is due to that difference in that one gene. And so that trait or that observation is secure in your mind as being related to that gene and not something else. So that, you know, so it's just a matter of finding that gene and then working back to say, okay, well, why is it that the presence or absence of this gene causes this trait? Or, as Joe thought from the study, from his ability to discern that this one disease was due to a single gene, that if he could just trace back from this trait, he could find the defective gene. And yeah, so he kind of had this other perspective on science, applying genetics to studying science, and then also in the process working out genetic defects.